had seen their relationship's demise play out. Walt didn't know how to deal with Mellicent's tears or depression, and her life was suddenly bringing him down. Terminal cancer was a definite downer. He said she had changed. It was a rude awakening for Mellicent to learn how shallow their relationship was. When she was packing to leave, Walt made her reopen all the boxes to make sure she wasn't sneaking off with one of his prized books or overpriced kitchen appliances. His pettiness and insecurities were embedded within his things, and she assured him she didn't want anything of his. In her heart, she didn't want him. All she wanted was for her mother to get well. Mellicent's mother put on a brave face as she underwent a valiant battle against the cancer. But in the end, it was a battle she lost. Mellicent finished the globe Rowan had held during the most difficult moments of her mother's passing, in the pockets of time between the tears. It had been wrong for him to touch it, but he hadn't known when he'd picked it up how personal the memories would be. He understood why she wanted to sell it, because somewhere in the recesses of her subconscious, she wanted to let the pain go. Memories lived in possessions, but most people didn't realize just how much. Mellicent never expected anyone to recognize the pain within her work. How could she, when she didn't herself? Rowan had not only exposed her wounds, he had exposed her, holding up a mirror with his words. Things were getting off to a bad start. He tried to explain. "I didn't mean to infringe, I promise. I came here to tell you there's a group of psychometrists who share the same abilities."
"You're kidding."
Her brow furrowed.
"People like us?"
The "us" made him pause. He studied her face, wishing he didn't find her so compelling. His fascination with her was complicating matters. He shook his head. "A group of archaeologists and an historian." A dead historian, he could have said, but refrained. "I'm not a part of their group, but my friend is, and he's missing." He watched her eyes widen in shock as he tried to explain. "They've been researching rare artifacts only psychometrists can identify, and someone might be trying to interfere with their work. I came here to tell you that anyone labeled as a psychometrist could be at risk. If I've seen that YouTube video of you, then they could have too. I wanted to warn you." Mellicent didn't say anything for a long moment. She looked terrified. He regretted having to alarm her like this, but she needed to be aware of what was happening. When she spoke, he could detect the shakiness in her voice.
"You flew all the way from New Orleans to warn me about what's been happening to this group of psychometrists?"
"If these people who are going after my friend's group think you're a psychometrist, they may come after you too. I can't have that on my conscience." He waited for her to ask him something else, anything. Instead, she sipped her wine, lost in thought. It made him question her.
"Has anything out of the ordinary happened since the video came out?"
"You mean besides selling a watch for almost $2 million and ending up in the LA Times?"
She finished her wine, looking anxious to leave.
"Thank you for letting me know, really. I'm sure everything will be fine."
She licked her lips, nervous, and gathered her things.
"Sorry, but I have to dash."
What he'd said had struck a chord, he could tell. She was already afraid.
"Listen," he leaned forward and lowered his voice. "I know you don't know me, and I know this all sounds crazy, but that pocket watch got you on YouTube. You don't know who could have seen it."
"You did?"
She tried to joke, but failed. They stared at each other for a suspended moment.
"Take my card." He held it out. "If anything happens, please call me, day or night. I'm going to be in town a few more days. I'd like to talk again before I leave."
She took it, trying to downplay his warning.
"And do you plan to read the rest of my artwork and let me know what other private moments you can see?"
Her eyes flashed with anger again. He still wasn't forgiven for reading the imprints.
"Or maybe there's something else you'd like to buy? Like 3 dozen lanterns from Doma Ling?"
She tossed her hair back with a defiant flick. Rowan let out a surprised laugh.
"I won't read the others."
He met her eyes.
"And I'll think about the lanterns."
"Goodbye, Rowan West." She said his name pointedly, even though he'd never said it. She must have remembered it from the store. Her eyes trailed over his face, his gloved hands, and then landed on the wine glasses. She raised her gaze back to him.
Thanks for the wine. Don't touch my glass when I'm gone.
She gave him a sharp look and walked away. Rowan laughed to himself, feeling firmly put in his place.
I won't, he called out, watching her leave.
Maybe he would go buy all 36 Doma Ling lanterns. The look on Mellicent's face would be worth it. He stared at her wine glass across the table, and damn it if she hadn't known how tempted he was to take off his glove and touch the stem to see what she'd been thinking. He hadn't touched a woman's wine glass in years, and although the temptation was strong, he would never go back on a self-made promise. When Rowan had first started seriously dating in his early 20s, he used to reach over and touch his date's wine glass all the time to read her mood and gather what information he could to improve his chances of having a good evening. But his wine glass reconnaissance always backfired on him, because most of the time the imprints he picked up from the glass had nothing to do with him or what he and his date were talking about. The woman had broken up with her boyfriend and was looking for an escape. Another was obsessing about how many calories were in her Merlot. Another kept wondering what Rowan and her future children would look like. Another was in a deep depression, hated her life, and thought Rowan was boring as hell. Rowan had run the gamut of emotions and judgments to the point that he debated whether he should stop dating altogether. He'd complained to Holly about the wine glass imprint fiascos, and she'd chastised him for spying on
those poor, unsuspecting women.
She said it served him right. He would never find anyone by using his gift in such a devious manner. Her reprimand stung, but she was right, and Rowan never touched a woman's wine glass again. The women he dated never knew about his ability, and he preferred to keep it that way. It was usually easier if he took off his gloves when he was with them and tried to tune out the sea of imprints surrounding him. The problems always arose when he'd have to touch something of hers, and then he'd get caught with a thought or a feeling he'd rather not know. And God forbid if he held her hand. A hand-to-hand connection with a person always gave him the most powerful read of someone's thoughts and feelings. The one time he'd wanted to reveal his ability had been a disaster. He'd thought Gianna might have been the one to start a lasting relationship with. At least he'd been ready to try. She'd even moved into his place, slowly at first. A toothbrush, a change of clothes, then a drawer full of clothes, then half of the closet was hers, until all of her things had migrated, and they were talking about whether it would make sense for her to sublet her apartment. When Rowan finally told her that he was a psychometrist, he'd made the mistake of holding her hand when he did, feeling all of her confusion, judgment, and distrust, and then deceit, when she tried not to let those feelings show on her face. The hurt hit him harder than he expected, and he ended the relationship. The breakup hadn't been pretty. He let Gianna take all of the furniture when she moved out, even though most of it was his. He didn't want to revisit any of the memories embedded there. He bought all new furniture and over time emotionally recovered. That had been almost 2 years ago. Gianna was the last woman he'd taken his gloves off for, and he'd never allowed anyone to get close since. He couldn't imagine attempting a relationship with another psychometrist. Not only would he have to worry about holding her hand, he'd have to worry about her holding his. The problem was that was exactly what he wanted to do with Mellicent. With a frustrated swipe at his glass, he finished his wine and left. If Mellicent didn't call the day after tomorrow, he would visit the shop one more time. To say what, he wasn't sure. He couldn't leave L.A. without her believing she was a potential target. He'd stay here 2 days, and then he had to go on to London. The boutique hotel Rowan checked into nearby in Venice Beach had funky graffiti art on the walls outside and surfboards mounted above the sofas in the lobby. The hotel clerk at the check-in counter glanced twice at Rowan's gloved hands while he filled out the registration form.
"You from up north?"
the girl asked, popping an enormous gum bubble.
"Something like that."
Rowan was used to the question and had stopped caring years ago. His gloves were like oxygen, and he couldn't go without them, especially in hotels, the Grand Central Station of imprints. When Rowan got to his room, he opened his bag and took out the box Sun had given him. He finally had a block of time to analyze the gift. He only hoped it wasn't another Upart. He sat down at the small desk and placed the box on the table. He took off his gloves and laid them aside. His hands joined together in an intricate Manipura mudra, a fire mudra, performed to increase courage and mental will. Before taking any kind of known risk, Rowan always performed this mudra, and touching Sun's present was a definite risk. He had no idea what memories lay in store, or why she had given it to him. When he lifted the lid, he found a fan made of carved, lacquered bamboo. With the care of a surgeon, he opened it up to reveal an exquisite painting of a sapphire dragon, a white tiger, a red phoenix, and a black turtle circling a yin and yang symbol. He rested the fan in his hands and closed his eyes, feeling his mind begin to slip between the folds. He was about to meet the maker of this masterpiece. Wonju, Korea, 1949.
Why is the dragon blue?
Sun watched her grandmother finish painting the dragon's scales. The meticulous brushwork had taken her all morning. Sun had sat and watched every delicate dab and stroke.
This is the blue dragon of the East, the noblest of animals. It brings good fortune on its wings and is the head of the four symbols.
The fact that her grandmother answered meant it was all right to speak while she worked.
And the others? Sun asked.
A turtle, a phoenix, and a tiger, along with the dragon, circled a vibrant, swirling yin-yang emblem in the center of the fan. Sun knew the circle represented balance, day and night, male and female.
They are the four guardians of the world, her grandmother explained, standing at the four directions, protecting the fifth, the center. The most powerful point in nature is always the center.
Sun nodded. Her grandmother had used the five cardinal colors, blue, white, red, black, and yellow, to represent not only the five directions, but the five elements of wood, metal, fire, water, and earth. Even Sun, at the age of 8, could see that this fan was perfectly balanced. Her grandmother went back to finishing the painting. Sun could tell from her faraway look not to ask another question. Sun's grandmother had been born into a family of Siang Jajang, master fan makers. The trade had been in her family for more than 6 generations, dating back to the late Joseon Kingdom. She'd grown up in Jeonju, the seat of fan making in Korea. Her childhood home, an original Joseon Hanok wooden house, with an elegant sloping slate tile rooftop, was as old as their trade and was tucked away off a cobblestone lane in the center of Jeonju. From an early age, her grandmother had been taught to make both styles of fan, the round open-faced fan, the dandeon, traditionally meant for women, and the folding hand fan, the hapjuksion. Sun knew making each fan required 150 steps, and that a paper fan made of hanji, from Korea's sturdy mulberry tree, could last more than 1,000 years. The fans of her grandmother's family had been held in graceful hands at ancient court and had weathered the years, even the 35 years of Japanese occupation that ended with the close of World War II. Over time, Jeonju had become a melting pot, with more people arriving every year as the country kept expanding. The bustle of increased trade made Korean fans prized by foreigners abroad as well. Sun knew all this not because her grandmother had told her, but because Sun loved to touch her grandmother's fan-making tools, the hammers, stones, and knives her grandmother had brought with her from Jeonju. Sun's grandmother had married into a family who imported and exported goods from the industrial town of Wonju. And as Korean custom dictated, the daughter left her family to join the husbands.
Sun's grandmother gave away the fans she made once a year for Dano Festival, the fifth day of the fifth lunar month, when everyone across the country gifted fans to their loved ones, particularly to the elderly and the children, to prepare for the coming hot summer months. This fan had taken her grandmother many months to create. Sun watched her grandmother paint the last brushstroke and place the fan on the shelf to dry. Now that her grandmother had finished the final image, the blue dragon, Sun slid open the lattice screen door and slipped outside to play. The family lived on the outskirts of Wanju, near Cheoksan Mountain, in a large country house that had an apricot tree, a cherry tree, a vegetable garden, two pigs, and a chicken. The forest started at the edge of the garden and led up the mountain like a blanket of green, where ancestral tombs dotted the hillsides, and an ancient Buddhist temple, the Gyeongsa Temple, sat in the center. Sun loved to wander through the fields, touching the dome-shaped relics and laying her hands on the stones. When she did, she could often hear the voices of the past and sometimes see them like ghosts performing shadow puppet plays. One day, when she came home from her adventures, her grandmother gave her a stern look. "Who goes knocking on the door of the deep, deep mountain?" she asked, reciting the line from an ancient song. Sun glanced down at the floor, afraid her grandmother would be angry. "I was only touching the stones. They tell me stories if I listen long enough." Sun balled her hands up into fists, worried she'd said too much. Her grandmother beckoned to her. When Sun sat beside her, she said with a grave tone, "Perhaps you've been gifted with the sight." Sun shook her head, adamant. She knew all about the Mansin, the shamans, powerful women who could talk to spirits and call the dead down from the heavens to communicate with the living. Her grandmother and mother sometimes visited the village Mansin to receive divinations or make offerings to the ancestral gods. And once, when her grandfather was ill, her entire family held a cut where their Mansin came to the house with several other assistant Mansin to perform a ceremony to draw the illness out. The event had scared Sun to death, with the women clanging cymbals and beating drums as they called on the spirits. Sun shook her head in refusal at the thought she might be one of them. To be a shaman was a hard road and meant living on society's edge. "I only see old things that happened before." Her grandmother took her hand and squeezed it in understanding. "Good," was all she said. And they didn't speak of it again. In the spring, for Dano Festival, Sun's grandmother surprised her by giving her the dragon fan as a gift. Later that day, her grandmother and mother went to visit their Mansin to give offerings to the ancestors. When they returned, Sun could see her grandmother was distraught. From that day forward, her grandmother stopped making fans and working in the garden. Instead, she took to her bed. No one would tell Sun why. Sun made an effort to be the one to bring her grandmother tea and then take away the cup when she was finished, for the sole reason to hold the cup and try to understand what had happened. One day she sensed more than saw it. The Mansin had given her grandmother a divination of the darkness that was to come. Sun dropped the teacup with a gasp and heard her mother call out a strict reprimand from the kitchen at the sound of broken porcelain on the floor. But when Sun met her grandmother's dull, defeated eyes, she understood. A war was coming. Sun's grandfather always said that after World War II ended, Korea was a person broken at the waist, split at the 38th parallel with a communist North and democratic South. The capital cities of Pyongyang and Seoul became bitter brothers. That break between the two sides had been festering for 5 years. In Russia, Stalin refused the UN's attempt to reunify the country. He wanted a communist foothold in Korea, just as the Americans wanted a capitalist one. The impasse mounted until finally the wound was rupturing. Within days, North Korea advanced south to reunite the country. But it quickly became a massacre. They gathered up anyone they believed to be fighting for the West. Sun's family didn't know what to do. Leave their home and make their way south toward Pusan with the river of refugees, or wait in Wanju and see what would happen. Soon Seoul fell, and the North Korean army was taking over the whole country. Wanju was at a major crossroads, and there was no way the city would be spared. The South's Republic of Korea regiments were rounding up everyone in Wanju they thought might be aiding the North. Sun's father traded with China, which was North Korea's supporter, along with Russia. Sun's father also traded with other countries, but that didn't matter. To the South Republic's eyes, he was a communist sympathizer. Officers came and took him away one night for interrogation. Sun watched her mother scream and plead, her knees on the floor, begging them to have mercy and change their minds, but they wouldn't. They demanded that Sun's brother, Jin, her only sibling, come join the Southern regiments to prove the family's loyalty, and they took him with them. He was only 13. Sun's grandfather died in his sleep the same week, unable to recover from the shock of losing his son and grandson in one night. Days later, the North Korean army swept through Wanju, occupying the town as well as every village, all the way south toward Busan. The North wanted to punish its southern brothers, and they were brutal in their occupation. It wasn't until the UN and American forces arrived in full force that the invaders were driven back. The tall, big-nosed warriors from America struck hard and pushed back the North toward the Chinese border. When Western forces crossed the 38th parallel, it enraged China and woke their dragon. In October, the Chinese entered into Korea like an ocean, with wave upon wave of men. They moved in the night, in total stealth, coming in like a shadow tide, and attacked. With this new turn of events, Sun and her mother and grandmother waited for months in fear, unsure what to do. Now that Sun's grandfather, father, and brother were gone, the house was a skeleton whose brittle bones were about to break. The women began to make plans to leave Wanju and head south as soon as the harsh winter lifted. Until then, they kept hope that either Sun's father or Jin would return, because if and when the women did leave, the family would no longer know how to find each other. Soon the decision was taken out of their hands when a Chinese group settled 3 miles north of Wanju and began attacking down the riverbed. The thunderous barrages of artillery never ceased as more military arrived every day. The women packed what they could carry on their backs and stole away in the middle of the night. Sun tucked her dragon fan into the folds of her blanket, and she crossed the threshold of her home for the last time. She turned back and looked at all their belongings. In the silence, she could hear the house saying goodbye. Sun wanted to believe she would see these walls again, and she prayed one day that she and her family could return to their lives before the war. But instead, that night, they walked right into a skirmish on the hills where the Chinese had the high ground.
Sun!
Her mother put her arms around her as they ran to the bushes for cover. It was a moment Sun would remember forever, right before the bullet hit. Her mother's body jerked, exhaling from the shock. Then she was no longer holding her. She'd fallen back from the force of the bullet. Sun dropped to the ground, clutching her mother's body. Her grandmother knelt beside her, grabbing them both. Their cries were masked by the relentless barrage of gunfire all around them. For hours they stayed huddled together, holding Sun's mother in their arms, until the battle moved over the ridge to the west. Sun was unable to speak. Shock had robbed her of the ability. They would have to leave her mother's body to find shelter, to hide, but they had no means to bury her, so Sun covered her with her blanket. Only her grandmother was alive. The old woman was barely holding on, her head bowed in defeat. Her spirit had been wounded beyond repair. Her family was gone, all but one. The old woman's frail hand held on to Sun's, as Sun led her deep into the forest and up the mountain, where the caves might offer protection. Sun found a hidden alcove between the rocks, and she laid down their pallets. They had no water, no food, but for the moment, they were safe. She helped her grandmother to lie down, and then she nestled beside her. Her grandmother's hand reached out and clasped hers, giving her the faintest squeeze, just as she always did when Sun did something right.
"Do you remember the story of Princess Bari?"
her grandmother asked, her voice weak. Sun nodded. Her mother had told her the story many times at night before going to sleep. Bari was an ancient princess who lived long ago in the time of the Three Kingdoms, born the seventh daughter of a king who wanted sons. Her grandmother mustered up the last of her strength in order to continue.
"When she came into this world, her parents did not recognize how special she was, and she was banished."
Her quiet words filled the cave. The walls were listening.
"Years later, when they were dying, she came back to help heal them. She traveled to the sacred realms beyond this world to find magical water to restore their life. In return, she was granted exalted status, but Princess Bari chose to remain in the other world to help guide the dying to the next life."
The tears that slipped from Sun's eyes were silent. With each word, she could feel her grandmother's life ebbing from her.
"You're my Bari,"
her grandmother whispered, her voice growing fainter.
"You could lead me there, to your mother and grandfather. I could forgive myself for leaving you if you took me there."
She kissed Sun's hand.
"Please take me there. Then go back to Wanju."
Those were her last words. Sun could feel her grandmother's spirit being pulled away like a kite caught on the wind. Sun held on tightly to her grandmother's hand, determined to go with her. Her grandmother was wrong. She wasn't Bari, a courageous princess able to lead her to the netherworld. She was a scared girl, unwilling to be left behind in such a desolate place. As her grandmother's spirit departed, Sun gripped her hand harder and closed her eyes. A force pulled her up and out of her body, until she was floating, looking down on the mountain like a bird in flight. Sure she was dying too, Sun told her life goodbye as she ascended beyond the web of fear and hate the war had created. She was free. A brilliant light approached, growing bigger and brighter like a newborn star. As the light drew near, a feeling of incredible joy bloomed in Sun's heart. She looked to her grandmother, who now stood radiant beside her. Sun's mother came forward, surrounded by a shimmering light. Sun had never seen anyone so beautiful. Her mother embraced her and placed Sun's hand on her heart.
"You must go back,"
Sun protested. She couldn't imagine returning, not now, but her mother persisted, guiding her away from the star's light.
"You still have much work to do. We will be waiting."
Her mother led her away and let go of her hand. Like a curtain falling, Sun floated back to Earth, feeling as if she were a stone sinking to the bottom of the ocean. The coldness woke her up. Sun didn't need to reach out to touch her grandmother's body lying beside her. Her grandmother's spirit was gone, leaving behind an empty husk. The vivid memories of Sun's journey to the other side still circled around her. The feeling of immense love had not faded. Sun yearned to go back, but she didn't know how, and knew she couldn't. Gunfire and explosions sounded in the distance. Only now Sun didn't feel afraid like she had before. Her mother had sent her back. Sun covered her grandmother's lifeless body with her blanket. The cave would be her burial place. She climbed outside and moved as many rocks as she could to seal the opening so her grandmother's remains wouldn't be disturbed. Then Sun made her way back to Wanju because her grandmother had told her to return home. Halfway to town, Sun sat down on the other side of the road, too tired to walk anymore. She took her grandmother's fan from her pocket, her one possession left in the world. The paint dazzled in the sun, making the dragon's scales seem alive. Sun closed her eyes and fluttered the fan as the tears made a trail on her cheeks. A car was heading down the road. The driver slowed and came to a stop. A foreign soldier got out, his eyes filled with concern as he squatted to ask her questions with words Sun didn't understand. She knew she looked pitiful, covered in dirt and blood, her thin frame emaciated. The man went to the truck and returned with a canteen of water and a bar of some kind of food wrapped in paper. Sun tried to stand up to take it, but was too weak to rise. The man put his arm around her and helped her. From his touch, fleeting images and thoughts passed through Sun's mind. His grandmother mailed him care packages from a place called Virginia. He wanted to go home. His job was to pick up children on the side of the road and take them to the shelters in Wanju for the hundreds of war orphans found sleeping among the rubble. Now she was one of them. Sun closed her grandmother's fan and tucked it inside her shirt, letting it rest against her heart. 13. The Talisman. Rowan set the fan back on the desk and folded his hands into a compassionate heart mudra, the Hridaya. Sun had given him her touchstone, the object that carried her most important memories. The fact she had entrusted him with the fan was so humbling, so astounding, Rowan didn't know what to think. A well of emotion rose within him. He could still smell the war, the dead burning, the smell of napalm and its ammonia-like after-effects. The acrid odor filled his nostrils and lingered in the hotel room, even though he knew the scent only existed in his mind. He had touched many relics from the past, whose imprints of war had taken him to battlefields, but Sun had experienced those atrocities firsthand. She had lived through war's worst circles of hell and witnessed its annihilating force, witnessed it destroy the love that bound families together and send children to walk through the world alone. Sun had been such a child. An orphan of the forgotten war, she'd heeded her family's words and strived to live, forging her path through sheer, unstoppable will. Sun Kim had lived a monumental life. Where Rowan made sense of his gift by looking to the past and returning lost heirlooms to their descendants, Sun had looked to the future, saving children. Rowan had seen through the imprints in the fan how, when she became older, she left the orphanage in Wanju and used her gift to raise money to build a network of orphanages. Her company, Bari Home, saved children orphaned by war, not only in Korea but around the globe. Sun had estimated that more than 200 million orphans were lost in the world, an unfathomable number, with every day seeing 6 to 10,000 more children without homes. Sun was one of the global warriors leading the fight. The knowledge of her life and the last 70 years had been encoded into the fan, because Sun always kept it tucked in her breast pocket. The fan was her talisman. Talismans were powerful objects, embedded with the owner's essence, their thoughts and emotions. The longer a talisman was worn, the stronger the imprint. This fan wasn't a gift. It was a book of her life she had loaned him, and she expected it back, that much was certain. Rowan possessed such a talisman too, his lucky coin, which he'd kept in his pocket for almost 20 years. The coin technically wasn't even a coin, it couldn't buy anything, and it wasn't made out of gold or silver, but hardened plaster that had been enameled. He couldn't imagine giving it to a stranger. His coin was the original model Augustus St. Gaudens had made for the Gold Liberty Coin. Minted in 1907, the $20 gold St. Gaudens Liberty Coin was revered as the most beautiful coin ever made in the United States. Rowan knew the history by heart. St. Gaudens had been a prolific sculptor and was personal friends with President Roosevelt. Roosevelt believed only St. Gaudens could make a truly remarkable coin, something that would rival the coins of Europe and ancient Greece. The president, without obtaining congressional approval, hired the artist outside the mint. There was much resistance, particularly from St. Gaudens's arch rival, mint artist Charles Barber. The plaster model in Rowan's possession was the coin's original three-dimensional model in high relief, the finished masterpiece St. Gaudens envisioned. Lady Liberty stood poised in flight in front of the Capitol, holding a torch and an olive branch to symbolize peace and enlightenment, the rays of the sun blazing behind her. St. Gaudens gave this plaster coin to President Roosevelt for his approval, and the president bellowed in triumph when he saw it. "This is the one!" Rowan didn't need one of the gold coins this model had made. This piece of plaster was far more valuable. His model coin held all of the stories. It held St. Gaudens' passion, his drive, and the joy from his studio sessions as he sculpted Lady Liberty, working with Hetty Anderson, who he proclaimed was a goddess and the most beautiful model he had ever seen. Hetty was a rarity, an African-American model, who could pose for hours with perfect concentration, and she'd held Rowan's lucky coin in her hand as well. When Rowan found it at a swap meet in Virginia at the age of 10, he'd been fascinated by the drama, the challenges the most beautiful coin in America faced in order to meet the world had been substantial. The image on the coin needed to be obtained at press with one strike, but St. Gaudens' coin required 9. Rowan could hear Roosevelt's fist pounding on the desk of the Oval Office as he shouted, "I want this coin, even if it takes you all day to strike only one!" St. Gaudens' coin went into production, but St. Gaudens died of cancer in 1907, the year the coin was released. St. Gaudens never saw the final result. In order to mass-produce it, the mint had to use a model set in lower relief, but even slightly altered, it was still lauded as the most beautiful coin the mint ever made. The gold coins from St. Gaudens's original model were now worth millions, and Rowan's was perhaps worth even more. He always kept the coin tucked away in his pocket, as a reminder that the real worth of an object could never be measured by money. He fingered the coin in his pocket now, reassured to feel it there, and guilt consumed him for judging Sun so harshly at both of their meetings, first in France years ago, and then in New York. He'd taken the look in her eyes for arrogance, when really it was strength. He hadn't known her at all. Rowan returned to the Hridaya Mudra, and he could feel his thoughts centering as the enormity of what Sun had done hit him. She'd opened the window to her life and invited him in to see all her years tucked within the fan. She needed his trust, so she had sacrificed her most treasured possession to gain it. Anyone who possessed their ability had been marked as a target. Sun had given him her fan to help Rowan understand that he was entrenched with her in this fight. She had given up her secrets because she desperately needed his help. She needed an ally, and had chosen him.
14. The Tree. The first thing Mellicent did when she got home from the wine bar was put her hands on the house's front and back door to try and sense if the man had returned. She stood with her eyes closed, waiting for a new sensation. Anything. She could still feel the man's hold on the knob, his intention to harm them, to harm the house. She let go, more unnerved than ever, and hurried inside and locked the door. The alarm technician was scheduled to come tomorrow, but now tomorrow seemed too long to wait. She tried to assure herself they'd be fine for one more night. She could hear Parker upstairs in his room, and she called up, "I'm home!" He didn't answer. In the kitchen, a pile of his dirty dishes sat in the sink. Mellicent was too keyed up to nag him to come down and wash them. Her mind kept returning to Roan's warning. After the initial shock, the reality was beginning to sink in that he'd really flown from New Orleans to tell her she was in danger. She checked again to make sure all the doors and windows were locked. Then she went over to her desk and turned on the computer. Logging into her email, she found the YouTube link Parker had sent her. When she clicked on it, the views had climbed to 25,000. What the hell? Parker? He didn't answer. Then she yelled his name so loud he had to acknowledge it. His door opened and he came to the top of the stairs.
What?
Come downstairs. We need to have a serious discussion. His whole body radiated defiance as he stomped downstairs and plopped on the couch.
What did I do now?
Nothing. It's me, she said, rubbing her forehead. I haven't been honest with you about something. Parker perked up now that this wasn't going to be another lecture about school. She pointed to the YouTube video on the screen. I really did find those antiques with my hands by sensing the past. I am a psychometrist. There, she said it. Her brother gave her a nonplussed look.
I know. You got like $2 million for it and you're still not getting me a car.
Oh my God, you're impossible. Can you forget about the car for 1 minute? She wanted to scream, but tried to stay calm. Some guy came to see me today to warn me that I might be in danger because I am being publicly labeled a psychometrist.
What are you talking about?
Because of this stupid video. She pointed to the computer. People are looking for people who have my ability.
Your ability? What are you, Wonder Woman now?
No, I'm not Wonder Woman. She sighed. This wasn't going well. But I did sense the history of those things. How do you think I found the watch? He mimicked her.
You sensed it.
And he air-quoted her to boot. Okay, the point is, he came to warn me about it.
Because he's a psycho who saw the video.
He's not a psycho, she snapped, exasperated. Yes, Rowan West was a complete stranger. But something about him made her want to trust him. They had shared the lantern memory. She hadn't imagined that. What I'm trying to say is, we both need to be on guard for anything that seems odd or suspicious. She debated telling him about the garage doorknob.
So how long have you been like this?
He asked her.
Able to sense shit with your hands.
Watch your language. She pointed her finger at him. He rolled his eyes.
How long?
I don't know. A while, she said, unable to be more specific. Technically, it had been her whole life, though the instances had come in spurts. When Mom got sick, it got stronger, and after she passed away, I couldn't stop. She didn't finish explaining, but jumped ahead. And now I'm on YouTube. She made a gesture to the computer. So, we need to be alert.
Alert.
Parker air-quoted her again. Yes, alert, she said shortly. Can you please do that for me? He gave her a sullen look.
And the car?
Enough about the car!
You're the one who just got $2 million, and I'm riding the bus! What the hell, Mel?
Show me you are back at school and get your grades out of the toilet, and then we'll talk. Parker glared at her like what she was proposing was unreasonable. He stormed back up the stairs and slammed his door. That hadn't been productive. Mellicent swiveled in her chair to look at the computer screen. Just seeing the YouTube video on some psychic investigator's channel gave her chills. There had to be a way to take the thing down. It wasn't from Antiques Roadshow or connected to their show whatsoever. Someone with the camera crew or a person nearby in line must have recorded it and shared it. She fired off an email to the address listed for the channel. If they didn't take it down, should she hire a lawyer? She couldn't have this National Enquirer-esque video of her and the power of her hands on the internet forever. Why had she even said it in the first place, on camera? What had she been thinking? She spent an hour online researching what to do when someone posted a video of someone without permission, because she definitely hadn't signed a waiver for this. She clicked on various articles and read about public versus private places, reasonable expectations of privacy, commercial usage, and infringement. It all sounded murky and, in the end, didn't give her a clear-cut answer. With a sigh, she gave up for the evening and shut off the computer. She grabbed her purse and the accordion folder where she kept all their important paperwork and headed upstairs. She needed to fill out the life insurance application and double-check their passports. More than ever, she felt the urge to get out of L.A. Tonight, she'd start planning the details. Maybe book the tickets. Finding the watch was beginning to feel like a burden, not a gift. Now they might not be safe. When she passed by Parker's door, she almost knocked and went in so they could talk some more. She raised her hand, but then dropped it. Parker didn't understand. And if she tried to get into it more, he'd start to think she was crazy. There was only one person who grasped what she was going through, and she couldn't stop thinking about him, either. Tomorrow, she'd call Roan and ask to see him again and share her concern about the intruder. Tonight, she'd been too off balance about the snow globe to open up. But tomorrow, she would invite him over so he could touch the doorknob, too. He seemed to be so much better than her at reading objects. Hadn't he proved that with the snow globe? Talk about skipping over small talk in the get-to-know-you stage. She'd been so livid with him. But looking back, she also knew her anger wasn't fair. Her work had been for sale, out in the open, for him to handle. And he promised he'd only touched one when he realized the private memories tucked within it. Maybe she would ask if she could refund him for all the globes and get them back. Though, at the moment, Roan reading imprints off her artwork was the least of her problems. She needed his take on the doorknob because the more she placed her hand on the knob and tried to reread the imprint, the more she couldn't let go of the feeling that man had specifically come to her house because of her ability. He had tracked her down after seeing her on the internet. Just like Roan West. When Mellicent went to sleep that night, she dreamed of the lantern maker. She could hear the woman reciting a Buddhist prayer, and images of the lantern maker's life accompanied the words. Memories flickered through the dream like a pictograph whizzing by too fast. The woman's voice grew louder, expanding with a powerful resonance, and an explosion of sound, like a glass window breaking, woke her up. Mellicent opened her eyes to find thick smoke in the room, surrounding her in a fog. The acrid smell burned her nostrils, and she gagged for air. Frantic, she made her way to the door and grabbed her purse and the file folder sitting on her desk, instinctively knowing she might never be coming back. She ran to Parker's room through the smoke-filled hallway and saw flames licking up the staircase. Parker! She ran to the bed and shook him, but he was listless. Parker! She rocked him hard. Get up! She wrapped her arms around him and tried to sit him up.
What are you doing?
He mumbled in a groggy voice, his eyes half closed. There's a fire! You have to wake up! She opened the bedroom window and threw her things down into the front yard. She rushed back and put her arms around Parker's middle to pull him to his feet. They made it to the window where she forced his head outside to get air. The fire was crawling down the hallway. Soon it'd be in the room. The tree by Parker's window, an enormous old camphor with thick, knotted branches, was their only chance. Sadie had been wanting to trim all the trees in the yard for years, afraid that several might damage the house, but she couldn't afford the expense. Now Mellicent was thankful her mother never did. Parker was becoming alert as the brisk December ocean air hit him from outside, and he began to cough, clearing his lungs. Reach for that branch, Park. Hurry! Mellicent leaned him forward so he could grab onto it. Parker resisted, coming to his senses. He looked down at the 30-foot drop to the ground and froze in terror.
No, you go first.
No, go now! Her voice brooked no argument. They had seconds, and she wasn't going first. His body shaking, Parker reached out for the branch while she held him steady.
I can't!
He quivered, his fear of heights paralyzing him.
You can do it, Park, I got you!
Mellicent tried to support him with all her strength and forced him out of the window. He clutched the branch like a cat afraid to move. Crawl! Crawl to the trunk! The fire entered the room. Parker glanced back, petrified when he saw the flames. Melisandre yelled at him. Parker, listen to me. You have to get to the ground. It won't hold us both. But he reached for her instead. Mellie! Mellie! Parker, climb! I need you to keep going! She could feel the heat burning her back. Parker looked around, hysterical, and slid backward toward the trunk. His room was now a gulf of flames that was almost at Melisandre's feet. The bed caught fire. Melisandre had to jump out of the window before Parker could reach the trunk. The branch bent downward, threatening to snap. Parker cried out as the branch bowed. Melisandre hugged the tree in a moment of panic, but then she felt the strength within the wood beneath her fingers, and the sting of the bark was a relief on her skin. This weathered tree had stood beside their home like a guardian her entire life. She had climbed the branches almost every day of her childhood. It would not break on her. Melisandre closed her eyes and clung to it. Park, keep going, she said, breathing out. We're going to be fine. For the first time, she believed it. Parker scrambled to get off the branch. When his weight transferred to the trunk, the branch swung back up. The sound of sirens came from a distance, but the whole house was already engulfed in flames. The firefighters would have nothing to save. If Melisandre's dream hadn't woken her up, they wouldn't have survived either. When she reached the ground, she hugged her brother to her. They clung to each other, watching the house burn. A sense of certainty filled her that she would never be able to explain. Those paper lanterns she'd spent all day hanging and then dreamed about had somehow saved her life. 15. The house. Melisandre and Parker sat together in the back of the fire department ambulance, blankets draped around them, taking oxygen. The police had arrived, too. Melisandre stared at the ruins from the fire and listened to the investigator explain how the fire burned the longest and reached the highest heat at the point of origin. She closed her eyes, unable to listen to the man go on about V-patterns, electrical systems, and gas pipes. They had brought in their arson dog and found the point of origin in the garage, by the water heater right near the door. Her eyes began to water. The garage. Arson. But then, she had already known. After putting her hand on that doorknob, she had sensed how malicious the man's intent had been, and now this stranger had made her home a crime scene. He had burned down her house with her in it. The investigator explained there would be forensic testing, insurance inquiries, and legal considerations. For the house, there were structural and safety issues as well. They had a whole team collecting evidence and taking photographs and video. Melisandre was calm as she listened. Or maybe it was shock. She could feel Parker trembling and put her arm around him and squeezed him tight.
Do you have any idea who would want to do this? The investigator asked. Have you noticed anything strange the past couple of days? Any signs of forced entry?
Parker looked at her. The conversation they had had earlier tonight was in his eyes. He had scoffed at her then, not knowing she had been trying to warn him. Just as Rowan had tried to warn her. Yes, she admitted, her voice a whisper. She felt Parker stiffen beside her. I came home the other day and something seemed strange in the garage. When I touched the doorknob, she trailed off, unsure how she could explain it.
When you touched the doorknob,
the man prompted, busy taking notes. I could tell someone had recently been there.
Because it was unlocked or the lock was broken?
He asked, to clarify. No, I... Something felt wrong. Like a strong hunch. like something was out of place. The investigator nodded. He understood hunches all too well in his line of work.
We found accelerant in the garage, hidden under the water heater near the door, he said, and faint trails of gunpowder spread throughout the ground floor inside the house.
Gunpowder? Parker spoke up. He nodded.
There were trails along the floor paneling to spread the flames.
Millicent covered her mouth, her whole body shaking. That man had gone inside her home and laid down gunpowder.
Ma'am, can you think of anyone who would want to do this?
She shook her head, a sense of numbness setting in. She didn't know the intruder, didn't recognize him, but she'd sensed the impressions he had left. Her whole body began to shiver. Parker was the one who spoke up.
My sister recently sold an antique pocket watch for a lot of money. It made the papers and got on YouTube. Maybe some crazy person saw it?
The man nodded.
Might be a motive.
He wrote that down, too.
Do you two have a place to stay tonight?
Parker nodded.
Yes, sir.
All their neighbors had descended on them like a little army. They were huddled together in their robes on the front lawn, there to help in any way they could. Jim and Ruth Mercer lived right across the street and had already insisted that Millicent and Parker spend the night. The couple had offered them the guest room for as long as they needed it. The investigator gave Millicent his card and got her cell phone number. He would let her know when the house was released and keep her apprised of the investigation. He said to call him if she could think of anything that might help their efforts. Millicent stared at the destruction, overwhelmed. Tomorrow she'd contact Sadie's homeowner's insurance, if her mother had any. She didn't remember seeing it in the accordion file. One of the neighbors had brought the folder and her purse over to her after finding them in the yard. They were the only things she had left besides her car, which was parked on the curb in front of the house. She had been avoiding using the garage ever since feeling the doorknob. She also needed to tell Tish she wouldn't be in. She needed to call Parker's school, too. Then she stopped. Did her to-do list even matter now? Someone had tried to kill them. Would he try again? Millicent didn't know what to do. If this was about the $2 million, she didn't want the money. She'd give it back. She stared at the car. Roan's card was still inside. She'd stuck it in her cup holder when she left the wine bar.
I'll be right back, she mumbled to Parker, and got out of the ambulance. Where are you going? Parker asked in panic.
Just checking the car, I'll be back in a minute. She padded down the sidewalk, suddenly conscious that she didn't have shoes on, and underneath the blanket the EMT had given her, she was in her nightie. She didn't own any clothes anymore. Every object tied to her life was gone. Every memento, keepsake, work of art, and photograph, belonging not only to her but to Parker and their mother. Their computers, their hard drives, and files wouldn't have survived the fire either. A lifetime of saves had been obliterated in one night. Their home held more memories than she could imagine. Her grandparents had bought the house after they had married in the early 60s. Sadie had spent her entire life inside those walls, born and raised under one roof. The master bedroom was still full of all her things. And the boxes, good God, the boxes. Millicent had planned to sort them after the new year. Now all her mother's treasures were lost. The house, which had been the keeper of the memories, had been destroyed. Millicent stumbled under the weight of the loss, and when she reached for the car door, a sob welled within her. She heard the sound from far away, as if her ears were underwater. She opened the door and sat down in the car, finally allowing the full force of her anguish to come out. She put her head on the dash and wept. After several minutes, she pulled herself together and found Rowan West's card. She needed to tell him about the man who had done this.
16. The Circles.
Rowan couldn't imagine how Miguel and Stuart had linked crop circles to the Upar.